Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for joining me for this week's episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast. Today, we are talking to a guy named Ben O'Connell because I've got requests from our audience to talk about not just mixing, mastering, recording, music production, all that stuff. I'm getting more and more requests to talk about what to do with actually releasing your music and making money off of your music and getting your, most importantly, getting your music heard by actual people out there. Ben O'Connell of Songtrust is working with one of the dominant, biggest music publishers in the space. And these are people who help artists make more money from their music so they can have more sustainable careers in music. But he's also an artist manager. And I want to get some best practices from him on a few fronts. Ben, thanks so much for joining us today.
Appreciate you having me. It's great to be here.
All right, great. There's a bunch of questions I want to ask Ben. Like I said, we're really going to revolve around those questions of, first, how do we make our careers in music more sustainable? How can we look for new sources of income to maximize what we're already doing? And I also want him to put on his artist manager hat for us a little later on to talk about having a strategy for a release, because this is something I talk about in the podcast a lot. People spend all this time making their, you know, magnum opus, you know, recording that album they want everyone to hear, or even if it's just a single, but then they don't always put the same kind of effort or strategic thinking into getting people to actually hear the thing, which is just as important, if not more so, in a place you should be just as focused and have just as much thought and strategy as the actual making of the music. Because if we spend all this time making the music and no one hears it, and if we can't keep on doing it because we can't make it sustainable, it's almost like, what's the point? So, Ben, super excited to have you here. Thanks again for joining us. You're in Brooklyn, New York right now, right?
Yes, in Brooklyn. Was back home in North Jersey for about 3 months, you know, quarantining with the family. But back here in the city trying to get a sense of normalcy, you know, back into the swing of things.
Wonderful. Good stuff. I'm sure you are not alone in all that. Couple quick questions for you. I want to talk first about Songtrust, which is a company that you work with and have been working with for a few years now, them and their parent company. And then we'll talk about more about your artist manager role. But Songtrust, for those of you guys who don't know them, they are one of the biggest music publishers out there, particularly for independent and self-releasing artists. The first and foremost thing I want to get into is, what exactly is music publishing? What does a music publisher do?
Yeah, so I think it's pretty easy to understand what music publishing isn't. Number one, it's not book publishing. It's not even really, you know, copywriting your songs with the U.S. Copyright Office, right? What it really is the business of songwriting, you know, and that goes for songwriters that are writing, you know, records for potentially themselves or other artists. That goes for producers that are producing records for other artists, as well as artists that, you know, write their own music, essentially. So really what publishing is, music publishing, is the business of songwriting, and ultimately the administration, the registration, the collection, and the exploitation of your compositions, right? So
artists get to be the one doing the exploiting instead of getting the exploiting done. All right, I like this.
Yes, for sure. But, you know, pretty much every song that comes out, there are two copyrights, you know, a part of that song. Mm-hmm. One side you have the master, the recording itself, and on the other side you have the composition. And this is, you know, the other copyright that is in music that the music industry is essentially built on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people can't even really necessarily grasp this concept that, okay, this song that I'm putting out, you know, you're releasing a recording, there's also another copyright embedded in that recording, right? It's not just the master recording, it's also the lyrics and the melodies and the production, you know, underlying, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are releasing music, they don't even understand that they own this composition, this other copyright. And that they're, you know, pretty much already involved in music publishing if you're writing records and releasing music. So pretty much the role of a music publisher, you know, obviously they play various different roles, but at its core, it's really the administration and exploitation of those musical copyrights.
Right. Interesting. So I want to go deeper into this, and a few of our listeners are definitely going to understand what you're talking about, the two copyrights. I want to go into a little deeper and just how to make sure you get a copyright, which is not as complicated as some people expect it's going to be. Before I do, I have to do the thing I usually do before we start the conversation, which is shout out this week's sponsors. I'm so excited to get into talking to Ben. I forgot to do it. So number one, Focusrite. I'm talking into a Focusrite Claret Pre interface right now. They make amazing bang for the buck stuff. Some of the best inexpensive interfaces in the world. One of the best selling lines ever, the Scarlett series. If you're looking to get started with an interface, Focusrite's a great way to go. They also make some super nice high-end stuff, which I've owned over the years. Also, big shout out to SoundToys, making some of my favorite software effects. You can try out anything they make for free at soundtoys.com. Speaking of stuff for free, copyright. You don't actually have to do much of anything or pay much of anything to get your copyright, right? Can you walk people through that process of how do I get my stuff copyrighted? It pretty much happens automatically, right?
Yes. So most people are under the impression that you have to formally copyright your works with the United States Office of Copyright. Mm-hmm. That's not really the case. Your works are technically copyrighted and you are the inherent owner of those copyrights as soon as they're put into a tangible form. So if you're singing a melody in your head and you have it, memorized in your head, you don't technically own that because it's not in tangible form, right? It's just stuck in your head. But as soon as you record a voice memo on your phone, or you record that, melody into a Logic Pro session, or if you're a lyricist, as soon as you write these lyrics down, on a note on your laptop, on a note on your phone, those works, those words, those music are technically copyrighted at that point, and you are the owner. Copywriting it with the U.S. Office of Copyright is just really an added layer of protection. It's not at all required for you to release or publish your music. It's really just a kind of a safeguard if, down the line, maybe someone steals your melody or steals your riff. You kind of have that added layer of protection. But ultimately, as soon as it's tangible form, yeah, you're the copyright owner.
Yeah, to my understanding, the only reason people would register it is to prove the date upon which, you copyright it. So like you said, this, as soon as you record a melody or some lyrics into your, voice recorder on your app, you own the copyright. The copyright exists. The only problem is if someone steals that from you, proving it. So you've got to prove. Right. But you could potentially do that, I guess, by like emailing it to someone, and it's like time stamp. Like there's a variety of ways to prove it. Back in the day, people would like record their thing on a cassette, send it to themselves in a self-addressed stamped envelope, dated, and they'd be like, aha, I have the proof in case anyone ever steals my song. But doing it formally with the U.S. Copyright Office is something that people might do. But as long as you have a way of showing when you created the song, you pretty much are covered, to my understanding.
Yeah.
So the two copyrights, and then we want to get into actually how to exploit these so you can make more money off of the things that you're already doing and have a more sustainable career. The two copyrights are what I believe would be called like the master recording copyright, right? Where the actual recording you made has a copyright associated with it. But there's another copyright associated with the actual like ephemeral work, the song that could be recorded in so many different formats. So there's both of those. They both have potential royalties and copyrights that go along with them. The music publisher, do you guys deal with one or both of those types of copyrights?
Right. So music publishers are primarily dealing with that second copyright that you mentioned, which is the composition.
Right.
So typically, music publishers are signing songwriters and producers that, own a piece of that composition in a similar fashion in the way in which record labels will sign artists and engage in either ownership or co-ownership of their recordings. Mm-hmm. So publishers focus on that other copyright. And it's primarily, as I mentioned, the administration, the registration, the collection, but also the exploitation, pitching songs for TV or film, licensing opportunities, pitching their demos to get placed with other artists for them to re-record it, right?
Right.
But an example I like to use just to kind of visually represent these two copyrights. I mean, number one, I think of every original song that comes out as a two-sided coin, right? On one side, you have that master recording. On the other side, you have the composition. But the best way to really highlight it is think of a cover. Right. So Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, very famous song. Think about how many different versions there are of that song, right? Probably hundreds, if not thousands. All 1,000 different versions, those are different master recordings, but they all stem from the same original composition copyright. If Leonard Cohen wrote that original Hallelujah 100% himself, he technically, or his publisher, whoever represents his catalog, has the right to collect the publishing royalties, the composition income, on all those different master recordings, right? So it's all these different versions of the same song. What are they stemming from? That same original melodies, riffs, lyrics, underlying, you know, production, essentially.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So what are some of the avenues that you're seeing clients of SongTrust being the most lucrative in terms of actual publishing income? What are the things where they're generating the most income, and what are the things that you think a company like SongTrust helps with the most? Are you guys helping to generate additional income, or is it just keeping track of the income that they should be getting? I guess that's a two-part question, but the first one being, what are the most lucrative areas that you're seeing for your own clients?
Yeah, I would say ultimately royalties stemming from streaming, you know, that goes for both performance and mechanical royalties stemming from streaming. So if you're an artist and you're releasing your own music, or you're a songwriter or producer and you're either writing or producing for other artists, all those songs, you know, they're available on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, various DSPs, and they're generating different types of publishing income based on those streams. And so if a producer comes to me and or, you know, maybe an artist, and they're making money on the distribution side, they're doing shows, they're doing merch, you know, they're successful in certain ways. What they're really missing out on is this extra pool of publishing income, essentially, that's being generated by those same streams that they're collecting on the master for through their distribution company or their label. But what they're really neglecting, essentially, is this other pool of money that's being generated. And to your second point, are we going out and, you know, procuring opportunities and generating new sources of income? Not really. I mean, this money is being generated already based on people streaming your music, but most people just don't have the infrastructure to actually collect it. And what we provide is that infrastructure, that access, that technology to allow people to collect the royalties that are already being generated. They just aren't set up to properly collect.
Right. So if we're talking about the idea of finding new avenues to make money through, getting your song placed with a major artist as a cover, or getting it placed with them as, you know, they get first dibs on the song, or placing it in a TV show, that's more where a different type of service might, like it could be an artist manager, like what you do, you know, in your other job, or it could be there are certain companies that specialize in music licensing and getting music placed. So those are two different things. But the streams, this is interesting. I want to talk to you a little bit about that. Back in the day, a music publisher, when CD sales and record sales were the thing, they would have been responsible for one portion of the royalties. And would those have been the mechanical royalties, like the statutory songwriting royalties? Was the publisher responsible for that stuff back in the day of physical media?
So in a sense, yes, actually the label would be responsible for paying the mechanical royalty for like CD sales and vinyl sales. But if that writer was represented by a music publisher, then the publisher would be receiving that, mechanical royalty directly from the label.
And then keeping track of it and then disbursing out to the artist. Right.
Exactly.
So the same kind of thing is happening now today in the digital world, where if we're going to distribute a song, tell me if I'm getting this right. If we're going to distribute a song, we're going to say DistroKid, and they're going to be our digital distributor, who incidentally have sponsored the podcast in the past. If you want to get 7% discount on DistroKid, you can go to our special VIP link. Look at how I'm just effortlessly putting this plug.
There you go.
DistroKid.com/VIP/SonicScoop, and you can try out DistroKid. But DistroKid, they're just one example. They're a digital distributor where you send them your music and they get it on all of the digital platforms. They get it onto iTunes to buy, onto Google Play, onto Spotify, onto Amazon Music. And then through DistroKid or whoever your distributor is, you get paid like the per stream rate, right, that Spotify calculates, or the per sale rate that that iTunes calculates. So correct me if I'm wrong, for iTunes, it's like you spend $10 on an album, three of those dollars are staying with iTunes, seven goes to the artist, that goes through the digital distributor to the artist. And the same thing with Spotify. They might say, hey, based on our calculations this month, you're getting, you know, a half a penny per play, or, you know, 0.9 cents per play, whatever it is. And they're sending that. But that's not all the money they should be paying you. There's also on top of that, a separate mechanical royalty that artists may not be collecting. Did I kind of describe it right? Do I understand this?
Yes, for the most part, pretty accurate. I would say your distribution company, a DistroKid, CD Baby, a TuneCore, they're not technically responsible for paying you these publishing royalties, so it's not actually on them. And it's not actually just mechanical royalties. It's actually performance royalties as well that are being generated, right? So let's say you put out a song through DistroKid. You write and produce this song. You you record over it. You own essentially 100% of the master and 100% of the publishing, the composition, right? Because you wrote and recorded, produced this record. So you put that out through DistroKid. It gets 1 million streams.
Yeah.
Awesome. Good job. In DistroKid, you know, the royalties that they paid you for that master recording, let's say it's anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000, right? For that 1 million streams. That same 1 million streams, you know, some are in the US, some are in Canada, some are in different countries in Europe, different countries in Asia, right? Australia, so on and so forth. That same 1 million streams are generating both performance and mechanical royalties on every stream. And this goes for every, you know, DSP, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, et cetera. So moral of the story is, yes, you're releasing music through DistroKid. That's a great start. Maybe you're registering these songs with your local PRO, such as ASCAP or BMI, but there's still essentially royalties that are being generated through different DSPs in different countries, being collected by different pay sources that you're basically leaving on the table if you're not working with a more traditional publishing administrator like a song trust, right? So we do help collect those mechanical royalties that you're not currently accessing through DistroKid, but there are also performance royalties as well that are being generated from all of your streams.
Interesting. Okay, so a couple more questions here. One, someone who didn't know this up until now and has been missing out on some of this publishing revenue, could they hook up with a company like SongTrust and get like back publishing revenues that they should have been owed? Like, is Spotify or whoever keeping that in escrow? Like, they have uncollected funds, and is there like a statute of limitations for how far back you can go? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So typically, you know, you put a song out, let's say in 2015, right? It's on all the DSPs, it's streaming. And in 2020, you wake up, you're like, oh, I realize I haven't been registering my songs globally with a song trust or another solution, right? How much of that pool of money from 2015 to 2020 am I going to be able to access? Typically, we tell people you can go as far back as about 2 to 3 years globally, but it really does depend on each individual unique society, right? So in theory, you know, the collection society in Italy might have, you know, a 3 year window, where the one in Germany might have a 7 year window,
right,
but the one in France might only have a 6 month window, right? And by the way, these aren't exact figures based on those countries. I'm just using that as an example. But typically it's about 2 to 3 years. Again, certain societies will let you go back further, but it's always better late than never at the end of the day. You know, you're going to get some, if not most, of that back pay, depending on when you started releasing music. But really, you want to get on top of this now so that if we talk again in 2 years from now, you know, you didn't wait and you didn't miss out on another 2 years worth of royalties, right? Like, the idea is that your songs are still today and will be, they're available on different platforms, streaming all around the world. And going forward, you know, you'll want to be able to maintain the collection of that stuff as it's coming in rather than working backwards, you know, essentially.
Man, this is interesting. Your comments here making so many more questions come into my head. And one of them is about, say, iTunes, conventional buying music digitally, which for younger people probably are doing much less of, and they're just streaming instead. But it's still, you know, a significant portion of revenues for some people. The conventional 70-30 split with an iTunes or an Amazon when you're buying music digitally, the 30% that's retained by iTunes or Amazon, is a portion of that 30% supposed to be set aside for some of these mechanical royalties and performance royalties? Like, would it be an extra amount on top of the 70% you're getting, or is it different when it comes to buying versus streaming?
Yeah, so admittedly, I'm not an expert on iTunes downloads, but what I will say is, number one, a download will not generate a performance royalty. It's just a mechanical royalty, actually, in that sense.
Okay.
So just to give you some historical context, right? Performance royalties were historically generated. Let's say I'm in the 80s and I write a song for a band and they go tour that song. Anytime they play it, you know, in a venue, in an arena, at a live music venue, I'm owed a performance royalty because they've publicly performed my work.
Right.
And think about it, still 80s, 90s. If I write a record for a band or a singer and that singer is signed to a label and that label presses the song that I wrote into a recorded version on a CD or vinyl, and mm-hmm. then they sell that, I'm now owed a mechanical royalty every time that that's sold. And that's basically due to the mechanical reproduction of the song that I wrote, right? In 2020, in the streaming era, streams on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, et cetera, those are generating both performance and mechanical royalties. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you know, if I play a song out of Spotify, out of my laptop, in a sense, it's being publicly performed, kind of, and in a sense, it's been like mechanically reproduced into a stream.
Right.
About the iTunes download, so if you're self-releasing your own music through a DistroKid and someone downloads your song on iTunes, you know, in theory, you as the label are supposed to pay yourself as the artist, mm-hmm. just like it typically works, but you don't pay yourself, right? Because it's not like that pool of money is yours regardless. You don't have to pay yourself as the label paying yourself as the artist, right? But if you're signed to an indie label or a major label and they're releasing, you know, CDs or vinyls, or people are downloading your songs on iTunes still, that label, which is not you anymore, it's another entity, they are actually responsible for paying you a mechanical royalty for those digital downloads and sales still. And there are nuances involved, you know, in terms of what your deal with that label looks like or what your deal with your publisher looks like in terms of what percentage of those mechanical royalties are you receiving? You know, did you get an advance? Does it go towards recoupment, et cetera? There are a lot of factors. But to your question about the 70-30 iTunes split and are they reserving it?
Whether that would include mechanical royalties or baked into the 70 that you get, or whether it's part of the 30 that they keep and then the publisher has to get it. But that would be something to find out. But in either case, it sounds like when something is reproduced as a recording, there is supposed to be a mechanical royalty that's statutory, meaning, you know, it's by law set, it's not just negotiated, that you would get. And that would mean like a stream. When something's reproduced as a stream, there's a mechanical. Reproduces a CD, reproduces vinyl, reproduces a download, there's a mechanical royalty. The other type of royalty that you guys also handle is the performance royalty, which is this thing gets played publicly. And theoretically, if you're streaming stuff, hey, particularly in a bar or a club or something like that, the performance royalty becomes relevant. But also if a cover band's playing it or some other singer. Now, this idea of the performance royalty has always been tricky because it's like, how do you track what music bars and clubs are playing and what cover songs are being played? So to my understanding, the way that the world of music publishing is handled in this in the past is kind of by guessing a little bit, but also there's supposed to be questionnaires that clubs and venues fill out about what songs are performed. How well that data is kept is very questionable. So to a degree, I feel like it comes down to guessing based on how many record sales. Oh, you got a ton of record sales, so let's just figure that probably your stuff got played in clubs a lot and maybe covered a lot. Is that kind of a correct understanding of the way that works? Because it's so nebulous.
Sort of, for sure. There is a more formal process when it comes to live venues, bars, restaurants. They do legally have to pay essentially blanket license fees to the PROs in order to play music. And whatever license fee that you're paying as a venue is most likely dictated by like your capacity and how much revenue you generate per year, how many people are attending your shows on average.
And a PRO, just sorry to interrupt, a PRO, for those people who don't know, performing rights organization like ASCAP, like BMI, what's the one in Europe, do you remember?
There are a ton. I mean, there's PRS in the UK. There's, you know, SACEM in France.
Right, SACEM is the one I was thinking of. So these PROs, people would register with them as songwriters, and that is to collect those performance royalties, right? So how does...
Correct.
Is it redundant or not redundant to have both a publisher and a PRO working on the performance royalty side of things?
That's a great question. So speaking as a songwriter myself, someone who is with BMI mm-hmm. as a songwriter, as well as actually with SongTrust as a songwriter, being with a PRO is really the first step that every creator needs to take to collect anything that they're owed on the publishing side, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not with an ASCAP or BMI, you will pretty much not see any of the royalties that you're owed. Mm-hmm. And why it's so crucial is what they do is they give you this IPI number, and it's essentially your unique songwriter ID code, right? So in theory, there could be 1,000 Ben O'Connells in the world writing and releasing music, right? If you're registering a song and you're crediting me, how are you going to properly credit me if you just list Ben O'Connell BMI, right? You need to actually put in my 9 or 10 digit unique songwriter ID so that I can be tracked throughout the world. So it really does stem from metadata at the end of the day in terms of how all this stuff gets tracked and collected. But really the main difference is between a PRO. So you sign up with a PRO, you get your IPI number, maybe you're registering, you know, your catalog of music with them. And that's great. That's a great start. What they're primarily paying you is just performance royalties, and primarily from within the local territory in which they exist in. So if I'm with BMI, BMI is primarily paying me my US performance royalties. They do collect internationally, I should mention, through what are called reciprocal agreements. But the difference between a PRO and what, let's say, Songtrust does is Songtrust takes your songs. Let's say you register, you know, 5 songs with us. We turn around, we take those songs and we register them directly with BMI, as well as more or less every version of BMI around the world, both on the performance as well as the mechanical royalty side. So if you're, you know, take it from me, for example, right? I'm a songwriter, I'm putting out music, co-writing records. And in about 2 years, you know, I made roughly $1,000 with BMI. At the time, you know, seeing a few $100 every quarter, thinking this is publishing, this is what these royalties are. I'm seeing everything that I'm owed, right? At the time, that's what I'm thinking. And it wasn't until I essentially started working at Songtrust, registered my catalog with them. Same catalog of music in less time. Songtrust has paid me about $4,000 over the course of about 18 to 24 months. And that's really just to highlight, you know, what we're doing is we're taking your songs, we're registering them directly with more pay sources, more collection societies, both performance and mechanical, as well as, you know, monetizing YouTube and other various services. But that is also to say that, not to get too in the weeds here, but BMI is also paying me every quarter as well as Songtrust, right? These are sort of two different types of royalties. The royalty that BMI continues to pay me every quarter is what is called the writer share. That comes to me directly at 100% every quarter from BMI. And then my publisher share, which is inclusive of US performance and US mechanical royalties, as well as international performance and mechanical royalties. All that share flows through Songtrust now. So I'm getting paid by both, but I have a much more global, extensive and comprehensive collection network, essentially.
Gotcha. Interesting. So I want to get into a couple more practical numbers here. You mentioned that someone got, say, 1 million streams on Spotify that they might get. This is not royalties, but just streaming fees of, say, $3,000 to $5,000. So a third a penny to a half a penny per play. And that's kind of where it's been sitting, especially since so many people listening to Spotify are on the non-premium services, you know, kind of holds down the per play rate. But, you know, $3,000 to $5,000, hey, I'll take it. You know, it's definitely good extra income to have in addition to my whole strategy as an artist. It's not the one thing that's going to sustain me.
Right.
But this does not count any of the royalties that we're talking about now. Based on that same 1 million streams, how much extra do you think artists are leaving on the table if they're not properly signing up with both their PRO and a publisher like Songtrust?
Right. That's a great question. Admittedly, the composition, at least when it comes to streaming, generates just significantly less than the master does. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of for a variety of reasons. I think just typically the industry values recordings and artists more than they value songwriting and songwriters and producers.
At least in the streaming paradigm, that's kind of not how it worked in the record making paradigm in the back in the day. The way to make it then was being a songwriter, but now it seems to have shifted a little bit.
For sure. So generally, going off that 1 million streams on Spotify, let's say it pays you $3,000 to $5,000 in your distribution account, that same 1 million streams is going to generate about $400 to $800.
Mm-hmm. So it's another 10%, maybe 15% or something like that, which is, again, I'll take it. If I can increase my earnings by 10 to 15% every year, it makes me happier.
It's passive, you know, and it's to your point earlier, it's already being generated. Mm-hmm. It's already being collected. And as we discussed, in about 2 to 3 years, generally, you will no longer be able to actually access this money. It does eventually get paid out to other creators and other publishers. So it is time sensitive in that in that regard. But yeah, about 10 to maybe 20% of what you're seeing on the master, I would say, is generally a good benchmark.
Right. But if you've been having a million streams a year for the past 3 years, then there could be, you know, a few thousand bucks waiting for you or something if you're able to collect on that past stuff that you didn't know to collect on. So definitely something that makes sense to get involved with. And now, correct, this is maybe historical at this point, but correct me if I'm misunderstanding this. I could have sworn that when Spotify like first came out and streaming was first becoming a thing, that there were no mechanicals associated with it. And there was it was like a non-statutory environment. Is that correct? And eventually the statutes got put in place so that it became royalties, or am I misremembering that?
You know, I'd probably have to dig a little bit for some kind of specific Spotify stuff in that regard. I know that, you know, the streaming royalties are not statutory in the sense, in the same way that a physical sale or download is, right? So it's typically 9.1 cents a unit, right? It's kind of the buzz thing around mechanicals for physical or downloads. So streaming.
That makes sense. So there's maybe a non-statutory mechanical where the major labels and Spotify negotiated together with what's an acceptable mechanical, and then all the indies kind of, you know, piggybacked on top of that agreement. So they kind of created an agreement with each other so they wouldn't have to take it to Congress or whatever to pass laws about how much you ought to pay, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and ultimately, they're not coming up with a per-stream payout proactively. I think they do it reactively. They say, how much money have we generated this month through subscription fees and advertising and so on and so forth? And then they look at the data, they look at the streaming data, and they essentially do it on like a market share payout. So every, you know, if a million streams 1 month might actually pay you a different amount than a million streams in another month, you know, because it depends how many people were streaming on Spotify that month, right? How many streams actually occurred. And real quick to your point about the different subscription tiers, you know, a free stream pays significantly less than a paid stream, right? So these are all factors that come into play. Also, they come into play about the 3,000 to 5,000 on the master side, and then the 400 to 800, right? If everyone is streaming your songs on a premium account, you know, those streams are going to be worth more. You're going to see probably closer to 5,000 or the 800 range. But if everyone's streaming your song on a free account, you know, you're going to be probably closer to the lower end of those ranges.
So the more I talk to you, the more that I'm going to almost throw away a question I had written down to ask you, which was something along the lines of, why would a label artist offload this work of publishing to a third party? Why not just be your own publisher? But with how complicated it seems to be, I mean, I guess that's it. The job of publishing is chasing down organizations from halfway across the world to shake them down for the few extra $100 you've been owed. And it's like, if you're not doing that at scale, that seems like some pretty tedious work, and you just wouldn't bother. So
exactly.
So I guess that's the answer, is like, we have Songtrust has a network of like people who are making sure the money's coming in. So let us, it's like an administrative job. It's not a creative job in the same sense.
And that's what it is. It really is administration. And Songtrust is a administrator in the sense that we don't own any of your copyrights. Mm-hmm. We strictly operate on a commission on the royalties that we bring in on your behalf. But you own everything. You're basically free to leave at any time. And since you own everything, it doesn't prevent you from signing a more traditional, maybe co-publishing deal down the line when, you know, you have more leverage, your catalog grows. But I do want to just mention that Songtrust is a admin company, but music publishing is a lot more than just admin, right? There are traditional publishers like our sister company, Downtown Music Publishing, which does, you know, offer advances, engages in ownership or co-ownership or even acquisitions of certain catalogs. And then there's a lot more creative push behind, you know, that artist or that catalog. So a company like a Downtown Music Publishing, if they sign a new writer, you know, we're going to do everything we can to get that writer or artist's music in TV shows, in films, in commercials, to, you know, get their music out there, obviously get new fans, get the streams up. Obviously there are licensing fees associated with all those uses, but certain publishers are more creative, you know, maybe a more niche kind of boutique publisher is really good at making records, placing a writer with another producer. They're really well connected. So they're placing, you know, demos with the major label artists, right? But maybe that boutique publisher doesn't have the global infrastructure to admin everything and to collect everything globally. So maybe, you know, they rely on a song trust. We actually work with I think over 20,000 other publishers use us to admin their catalogs. But what they're doing is they're focusing on the creative services that we don't really offer just because it's not scalable. You know, how do you tell 300,000 writers, hey, we're going to pitch your music for this TV show or for this film? Right. Sort of an empty promise. So, and just real quick to your question about the labels. Yeah, these are two completely different sides of the business. And the systems and the processes require different knowledge and skills. And, you know, publishers have building their world and their processes and systems for 50 plus years, and labels have been doing the same, and they're just different. They're different sides of the business. They require, you know, different efforts from these parties.
All right. That makes a lot of sense. So I spoke a little bit too loosely in the beginning when I was saying that, hey, shopping the stuff around isn't necessarily the music publisher role. It's not the role of a admin music publisher like SongTrust, but is the role of a more comprehensive music publisher like Downtown Music, which is, for example, is a sister company of SongTrust. So it's almost like we need yet another word to distinguish between these two types of music publishing. Is there a terminology? Would it be admin publishing versus 360 publishing? Like, are there terms to distinguish these two types of publishing?
Yes. So typically what SongTrust does and what other, you know, a certain type of deal that other traditional publishers offer are admin deals. It's really just admin administration. But then, you know, there are co-publishing deals where, you know, you can't just go on a website and sign up and get $100,000, right? It's a publisher needs to find your music, approach you. There's negotiations, but typically, you know, they're advancing you a sum of money up front. And in exchange for that, you know, they're either owning or co-owning some or all of your catalog of music, your compositions, your copyrights. And, you know, as I mentioned, sure, we give a writer or a producer $100,000 up front. We're not going to just, you know, say sayonara, right? We want to recoup that $100,000 and make some money on it in a mutually beneficial way, right? So this artist now, or writer or producer, has $100,000. Maybe they quit their day job. They have all this time to now focus on music, right? They're maybe putting some of that towards new equipment that they needed, or studio time, whatever. And the publisher now, you know, like I said, owns or co-owns these assets. And they're going to do everything they can to exploit them. And exploit, I think, kind of has a negative connotation, but pretty much just financially exploit them.
Yes.
You know,
we're exploiting the music, not the person. So we can both enjoy in the exploits of, you know, the music that we've exploited. Yeah, it does have this connotation where when you hear the word exploit in the terms of music, people are like, whoa, who's exploiting who? But the idea is we're exploiting the music, not a person. And I guess with a co-publishing deal, like you're saying, they'd be given an advance, say the $100,000, you know, just as an example. And then ideally, let's say in a co-owning situation, both the artist and the co-publisher own 50%, the first $200,000 that comes in recoups that $100,000 advance. And the co-publisher makes $100,000. So they've doubled their money. The artist made a decent amount of money and had it all come to them in the beginning. And now any money on top of that, they're both splitting 50-50 now that the advance has been cleared.
That's generally how it works, yes. There are, again, nuances with every specific deal.
Yes, this is an oversimplified version, but that's the structure and principles underneath it.
Pretty much it, yep.
So what kinds of artists tend to benefit the most from those kinds of co-publishing deals?
That's a great question.
Would these be songwriters that are writing for major pop artists, or is it more film scoring people, or is there any norms there?
I would say there's not really norms in terms of who signs co-publishing deals. I think for one, they're a little bit not outdated. I mean, people are still signing co-publishing deals at the end of the day. But I think artists having more leverage, being more savvy, having successful independent careers are sort of kind of trying to turn more towards admin deals where Maybe they turn down the advance because they don't need the money up front. They already signed a record deal and they already tour and crush it on merch. So they're good on the money and maybe they don't need the money up front. Maybe they'd rather work with an admin company like a Song Trust and just collect what they're owed, but still own everything. But maybe you have, you know, an up and coming writer who has no idea how the industry works. They're, you know, struggling financially, let's say. I mean, obviously this is one case. This isn't all writers that sign co-publishing deals, but, you know, what is going to cause you to take $100,000 up front? You know, you're probably in a situation where you need the money, or you're just an incredible writer, but let's say you have no connections and you don't have a manager, you don't have anybody pitching your demos or trying to place you in rooms with other writers and producers, you know, you can really benefit from that publisher's services, you know, and obviously there's a trade-off, right? You're giving up partial ownership of your music, but in turn, look at the services that they're going to provide, you know, so you can kind of think of it as a smaller piece of a bigger pie, I guess. But I don't think there's one broad stroke of the type of artists who sign co-publishing deals. I think generally, you know, artists that are very prominent and maybe signed a some publishing deal earlier in their career, and now they've maybe, you know, gotten ownership of their whole catalog back, and now they're, you know, at the level of a Drake or a Taylor Swift, right? They may now go do a co-pub deal for tens of millions of dollars, and right, they don't want to worry about the registration and the collection, right? They're just like, hey, give me 10 million. You guys can own this stuff. I don't care. I'm going to parlay this 10 mil into 100 mil, you know, doing my own thing anyways. So there's a lot of different deal structures.
Right. And so that's interesting. At the very high end, there's the time value of money where people are like, yeah, $10 million today to me is worth more than, you know, $20 million over the next 20 years. So right, you long-term investory types, you know, you make your percentage, you buy the catalog and you take the money over a long period of time. I'll take the money right now because I got other places I can put it, which are going to give me an even better return than my music catalog. So that's an interesting gambit to take, but that is like, that's not entrepreneurship 101. That is like some advanced stuff right there.
Totally.
Those are some of the mo money, mo problems we could all aspire to have someday.
Exactly.
But until then, I'm curious, we've covered so much ground here, and I want to leave a little time to talk about artist management, because that's your other side. And for the sure, numbers that we're talking about with traditional admin publishing are, you know, increasing the amount of money that you're making off of things you're already doing passively, you know, by 10% or 15% is wonderful, but it's not the whole entire thing that a music career is made out of. So what are the areas that you find that outside of music publishing and outside of streaming royalties have been most lucrative for the artists who are successful with Song Trust and are most lucrative for the artists that you've worked with as an artist manager?
Totally. Yeah, I think for a combo between the artists that I've worked with for Song Trust as well as the artists that I work with on the management side, one for producers, it would definitely be like producer fees, you mm-hmm. know? And typically that's with a major label. So obviously that's sort of a fringe case. Not everyone is out here producing beats or, you know, various production for major label artists. But the people that I've been fortunate enough to work with have had those opportunities. And, you know, some of those producer fees can be, you know, $1,500, $3,000, $5,000, $7,500, $10,000 maybe for one beat, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that doesn't include your 50% publishing maybe that you're also negotiating on the back end. So it's straight up producer fees, as well as, you know, obviously live music and touring is going to change, you know, going forward forever probably. And that's currently on pause, but shows, you know, doing shows at your local 150, 250 cap local venue. You know, you set those ticket prices correctly, you market that the right way, you know, you could walk away potentially with a few hundred, if not a few thousand dollars. So I would say production, you know, even work for hires, if you want to go down that route. You know, companies, even like SoundBetter is a company where producers and engineers and mix guys and master guys can go on and potentially, you know, service other creators for a fee. So for anyone out there looking to make some extra income, definitely look into SoundBetter. But I would say generally, yeah, outside of streaming and outside of publishing, it would probably be producer fees as well as touring. And then sync is another kind of random thing that you can't really predict, but you might just end up getting a $3,000 sync fee, you know, 1 month. And it's like, all right, you know, that's great. You know, we just pocketed $3,000 off a song that came out 3 years ago that hasn't even made $3,000 in streaming, but some TV show, some commercial, some indie film documentary maker values this song and they want to use the song. So I would say pretty much those three sectors outside of, you know, streaming and publishing are where people can look to make some extra income.
Gotcha. And when you say live shows, do you think of merch as being part of that, or do you think of merch as a separate thing that would be behind those other three?
That's a great question. I actually wasn't even considering merch when I said live. I'm really primarily talking about hard ticket sales.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you have merch, like, there's no reason why you shouldn't be setting that stuff up at shows, and then also, you know, kind of passively pushing that stuff on like social media and whatnot. But definitely merch as well. I think it's a little harder for artists that are like either starting out or don't really have a fan base yet to kind of push merch, because you really ideally have like a fan base that's actually buying that stuff. But I'm not going to put anyone in a box. You know, it's never too early to start pushing out your own merch at the end of the day.
Right. And it's interesting that, you know, a lot of the numbers that we're talking about here could potentially sound small to people compared to the cost of living and the reaching a average, you know, median income. But when we're talking about $3,000 here and $5,000 here and $1,500 there and $7,000 here, you do that 10 times in a year. And then all of a sudden, that starts to look like $30,000 and $50,000 and $70,000. So the idea of diversifying across these sources of income is big. And then the reality that so many musicians who are professional musicians, at least towards the start of their careers, are often either semi-professional, meaning, hey, maybe I'm only making $25,000 a year off my music, but I'm making $25,000 a year doing this other thing too that only takes up, you know, a handful of hours out of my week. Right. And I put those two things together and I'm really making a living. Or people are supplementing it with teaching. Or like you said, not just producer fees, but performance fees. So much of music is supported not only by the end listeners, the end consumers, who we think first and foremost as being the people who are going to put money in our pockets, the end listener. But there's also other people who do music at a really passionate high level as hobbyists, who have always put money in the pockets of musicians, producers, engineers. And those people, some of them may have career aspirations, but some of them are doing it because it's something that they love to do. And working on the music is a good in and of itself, and saying, I completed this thing. I got my magnum opus out there. I don't care if I make a living being a musician, but it's so much better because of the help of all of these professional or semi-professional musicians or technicians I worked with. So that's a component of it that I like that you touch on. Because it can be commercially with producer fees, a label is paying you, but also a decent amount of money that comes into studios or people who maybe they have a dream in the back of their head of someday making it as an artist. Maybe they don't, who love the process and want people who've done this really well to be by their side. So I think that's
absolutely. Two points about that. I would say one, one of the producers that I manage is pretty much a full-time like mix engineer. Mm-hmm. So full-time, he's doing like daily, you know, recording sessions, mix, master fees, stuff like that, on top of producing for other artists. And a big majority of his, you know, frequent client base is that demographic, you know, people who don't work in music, people who aren't necessarily artists, but yeah, they love music and they want to record an album, or they're, you know, they're a comedian and they want to record like a comedy parody album, you know, and are they going to take off on this music career? You know, maybe not, but everyone should have a right to get creative, you know, at the end of the day, in any way that they see fit. And just another point about, you know, the various ways that you can make money in music. I think, yeah, there's two things. One, get creative and start really realizing how many different ways that you can actually make money in music, not just from your actual music, but actual, you know, services, as we discussed, whether that's recording or mixing or mastering, or, you know, consulting if maybe you're on the industry side, whatever it is. There's various ways of making money in music. Get creative, but then also watch these podcasts, watch, you know, hop on all these virtual Zooms, learn the business, you know, there are so many various things that you need to do on an administrative back end level, just to see the money that is yours, just to actually access your own earnings, you know, and that's like just the beginning. That's the first step, right? That's not even thinking on the creative level of how do I get these beats out? How do I collaborate with other artists? How do I get, you know, this, that, and the third? It's really just, okay, I need to educate myself to do the bare minimum that's required to actually collect what I'm owed. And then, okay, let's get creative. Like, I'm a talented person in music, you know, let's think of different ways that I can ultimately make a few, you know, extra $1,000 here and there as ancillary income.
Yeah, I love it. All right. For those of you who want to end it here, this would be a great place to end it. I do want to go deeper. For those of you who want to go a little further, I'm going to ask some really specific questions of Ben that those of you who want to go deeper on this can check out. I'm going to ask him about the artist management side and particular best practices that he's employed with the artists he's worked with to take them from where they were to a much higher level. So we're going to go into the second half of the conversation. Well, not second half. We're going to go into another good 15 minutes maybe of this conversation. We're really talking about some brass tacks about growing your career and steps you can take and what's worked for some of the artists he's managed. For those of you who want to check that out, go to sonicscoop.com/Ben Songtrust, or you can put in his name, sonicscoop.com/Ben O'Connell. I'll have both of those links point to the same place, sonicscoop.com/Ben O'Connell, sonicscoop.com/Ben Songtrust, and that'll get us to the free extra part of this conversation all about artist management. We're actually going to be doing a series of interviews on this, and I'm going to put all the links to all the little special best practices and case studies from artist managers and music publicists onto one spot called sonicscoop.com/releasing music. So you'll be able to find, as we do in more and more of these, a whole bunch of these extra bonus features with real best practices, pretty actionable. Excited to talk to Ben about that in just a minute. For those of you who are just tuning out for the end of the podcast, thanks so much for joining us. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop with Ben O'Connell. Check Ben out at, well, first of all, check out his company, Songtrust, at songtrust.com if you want to get your music published and have someone take care of the admin side. Ben, for people who want to follow you, is there a particular place they should go?
Yeah, you can contact me on Instagram. It's at Benjamin O.
Okay.
The A is an X, and there is an underscore between the Benjamin and the O. So it's BENJXMIN_O. A little complicated.
Okay,
but
I will put that up on the screen and in the show notes for those of you who are checking out the video version, and it'll be in the show notes there on the podcast version too. Big shout out to our sponsors for this week. Focusrite, speaking to a clarinet interface right now. They make some of the best bang for the buck stuff when it comes to interfaces and beautiful high-end stuff too that you can check out. Also, Soundtoys, making some of my favorite creative mixing effects. Try out anything they make for free at soundtoys.com. Thanks again for hanging out with us. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop with Ben of Songtrust. See you next time.